So do you cook when you're at home in New York?
Very poorly. I tend to cook sweet potatoes and broccoli and some kind of meat, and then that's the only thing I make. It's good stuff. You got to put that
what
in
about
there.
That is poor? Like it doesn't taste good? You don't season it enough?
Yeah, both of those, I'd say. Yeah, the seasoning isn't done particularly well, and then the cooking itself, you know, isn't done particularly well, and so then the end result is that it tastes pretty mediocre.
Like you're talking soggy potatoes or like undercooked potatoes?
I get impatient and I eat the sweet potato before it's done. And in the case of the meat, I forget to like completely thaw it sometimes before cooking it. So of course then it's not good. And the broccoli, just don't like broccoli that much. This better be how we kick off the podcast.
So you're making a bunch of food that you may or may not like.
Well, I like the things if they were prepared better, but also just like, I just also tend to wait to eat until I'm really, really hungry, and then I'm just impatient, and I settle for it being extremely underwhelming.
Have you considered a slow cooker or an air fryer?
I have a crock pot, and I will prepare, in quotes, meals in that. But my problem with that is it makes a huge amount of food, and if the food is there, I just eat it. So I don't like the quantity sometimes. It's too much.
And you're not home enough for the leftovers to be valuable?
Well, it's just there aren't leftovers because I'll just eat it all no matter what it is. Does that make sense?
Does that happen to you when you go out to like a restaurant?
Yeah, but you can, the portion control is easier when you're at a restaurant because you just order a normal human's amount of food, and that's where you stop. You don't put in another meal, you know?
I know, but some of these American portions are kind of excessive. Do you just send it?
Well, I just send it, yeah, because it's not as excessive as eating an entire crock pot's worth.
I see what you're saying, but I guess in New York City, you're in New York City?
Yeah.
Yeah, in New York City, there's like, some of those restaurants are like hipster enough that they've started dialing back portions to like reasonable. So you have to like order the appetizer and the dessert actually to get full. The entree is not going to be enough.
Yeah, I agree. And that's a lot of money.
Eric, are you just warming up?
No, this is the meat and the potatoes of the podcast. Yeah.
Welcome to the River of Suck podcast, live here at Fiddle Hell, Westford, Massachusetts. I have a super special guest today, Jacob Jolliffe, hailing from the city of New York City. And sometimes we call him Jacob, sometimes we call him Jake. But here at the River of Suck, we're just not sure of anything, and everything is scary. So welcome, Jake, to the River of Suck.
Thanks for having me, Andy. It's good to be here.
Heck yeah. Well, so if you're just tuning in now and you're not live with us at Fiddle Hell, we should tell you that the context of this event that we're doing right now is we have about 500 people come into a beautiful hotel.
Yeah.
And set into the hills of Massachusetts, and people have just been jamming late, and it's just a really inspiring environment, and it's been great having you teaching people about the mandolin.
Thank
and
you.
Performing this week. Yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
This is the biggest fiddle camp. Is it the biggest one that exists? It's the biggest one I've ever been to, for sure.
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
But it's pretty, 500 people at a fiddle weekend is pretty good.
It's so big. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if you come, dearest listener, it'll be even bigger and even better. What's your experience been at Fiddle Hell like so far?
Man, I've had such a blast. Yeah, I've taught 16 sessions for each day, plus the show last night. And yeah, I always figure out a lot through doing this kind of thing about, you know, better ways to teach, worse ways to teach, and also like just about playing my instrument, you know, having to explain the same thing several times and really try to decide what's true and what actually applies and what's just a habit from me saying it a lot, you know?
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. I also love just, you know, I'm someone who, I play a lot all the time, but there's something different about like uncasing it to teach four times a day.
And totally.
It's just, it's great. I love it.
Part of the reason I bring up like your experience of Fiddle Hell is that somehow this interview got scheduled for the final session of the final day. And so after all this experiences of so many sessions in a row and late nights and early mornings and never enough coffee in the world, it's important to know that our filters are off, I think.
Absolutely.
It's safe to say.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I was feeling a little that way musically, too, in a good way when I was playing with Sharon Gilchrist and Grant Gordy earlier today. Ooh. We did a little show and I was feeling kind of like the filter was off musically after this sort of just inundation, you know, of the last few days.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it was super fun.
Well, so for anyone new to listening to Jacob Jolliffe say words or play the mandolin, and I think it's safe to say that mandolin is sort of your life thing that, yeah, that you figured out. I like to ask, what is your superhero origin story? And that's like, not just, it's sort of like, how did you get from someone who is a short person, I think they call them kids, right? From a short person to someone who plays the mandolin professionally. Like, what is that superhero origin story for you?
Well, let's see. So I started gigging when I was, you know, a short person still.
Yeah.
My dad started me when I was 7 as part of my homeschooling, one of many homeschoolers probably here this weekend, and certainly one of many homeschooled musicians that I knew growing up. But yeah, he started me when I was 7. I didn't like playing at all for about 6 months. And then I don't even really remember this at this point, but he said it was basically overnight. I went from practicing the required 10 minutes a day to several hours a day. And I don't know why. I mean, I'd already sort of made some progress even with the 10 minutes a day, the neuroplasticity of a little kid combined with having to do it every day. And I could already play some tunes, but something just shifted kind of overnight and started practicing hours a day. And then that just sort of kept up for the next 28 years since then. So I played in a bluegrass gospel band with my dad. That was a lot of the gigging I did, which was super fun. You know, when you're 9 years old, 10 years old, you know, being out to 2 a.m., coming back from gigs, like eating junk food, you know, that's the way you kind of party. And it, I loved it, you know. It was just so fun. And honestly, I still think sometimes when I'm on a late night drive with my band or something, it kind of reminds me of just like, I was kind of doing this like when I was 9 too, you know, or 10 years old. And
yeah.
But then, yeah, a lot of other stuff in between. I don't know, should I get into more of that or?
You can get into that.
Yeah, well.
What happened in between?
What happened in between? let's see.
Also, I'll add to that.
Yeah.
If something happened in between that was a disaster, I'm a big collector of disaster stories.
Yeah, okay. All right. I'll definitely give that some thought. It seems like there's been plenty of disasters. A lot of them mandolin related, you know.
Mandolin disasters.
Yeah. It's funny how fearful you are of mandolin-related disasters as a kid, and now I do try to sort of embrace them now, you know, and even sort of precipitate them, you know, or is that the right word? And, you know, sometimes now, you know, intentionally throwing yourself off kilter when you're improvising or something is something I look for, you know?
Yeah.
But so in high school, I kind of quit playing with my dad because it went from being the, sort of the best thing ever. And, you know, I still to this day love playing music with my dad, but I played gigs, you know, like over 50 gigs a year, you know, it was something every weekend from when I was like nine or so till I was 16.
Yeah.
And I had made a lot of friends already that were my age. Alex Hargraves, you know, we met when we were really young. Wes Corbett, Sarah DeRose, Dominic Leslie, and we all met when we were like 15 or so.
Yeah.
And so I had a lot of friends that were playing. I quit playing bluegrass gospel for a while. But then I went to Berkeley, you know, which is where I remember the first time I met you or maybe saw you play was your senior recital.
Oh.
With Stash recital? And Will and Devin, right?
Well, yeah.
Two of those people I don't even know that well. I just remember, you know, from.
Yeah.
And then Stash is one of my best friends. And I just, yeah, it was awesome. I loved it. And that was like, had to be my, first month or two in Boston. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. It was crazy.
What a wild thing that was your beginning and that was my exit, sort of.
Well, first, it was definitely the first senior recital I went to. Definitely, definitely. Nice. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of crazy. Yeah. But then, yeah, I was lucky, like, you know, when I went to Boston, a lot of the great musicians that started there when I did, I already knew a lot of them, you know, a lot of the cats I just mentioned. And then I pretty quickly, well, sophomore year of college, joined this band Joy Kills Sorrow, which was... mostly kind of a New England band at that point, but then this great mandolin player Joe K. Walsh was in the band, and he joined the Gibson Brothers, and so when he left to do that, I joined Joy Kills Sorrow, and then we started touring quite a lot. Just sort of that band had a lot of lineup changes, and sort of like when I joined, it was like maybe just the final piece for like a group that was kind of willing or ready to just do that for a while.
Yeah.
And we did just do that. So my college experience then at Berkeley is sort of one and the same in a lot of ways with my first touring and band experience. Like the two things were happening. You know, I was always like barely kind of keeping up with school because I was going on the road, and, which, yeah, not that uncommon at Berkeley, but.
No, not at all.
Yeah. Man, I feel like that. I mean, we had some disaster stories in that band that I can't even put on a podcast. But there was definitely plenty of disaster. And also, you're young, and you know, didn't always get along. I mean, I love all those folks and love the music we made. But you know, we were just basically kids.
Yeah, know? Bands are kind of like big polyamorous marriages that no one planned out very well.
Totally. Yeah, and that was definitely. That band was no exception to that. But like, I still the records we made, some of. The best music I've been a part of.
Yeah.
We had such a great time. I mean, there's no experience quite like your first touring gig when it's with like peers, you know, and you're all excited about the same thing. And so every like little break that the band gets, every festival or when we first got a booking agent, first got a record label, it's like everyone is so on board and everyone's also convinced you're going to be famous within a couple years. And there's no doubt in your mind.
This is the way. This is the path.
Yeah, exactly. And it's and it's the fun part, but it's also kind of the undoing because you put a lot of pressure on it then.
Expectations.
Yeah, yeah.
Oops. Yeah, I loved the band Joy Kills Sorrow, and I remember seeing it in multiple formations.
Yeah,
and it kind of kept. There was a while that I felt like it kept changing, and I liked it because I knew it was going to be good, but I didn't know exactly what was going to be new since last time. New songs, new people.
Yeah, and, yeah.
I loved that band.
Yeah, it was a really fun group. So it was Matt Arcara, guitar; Wes Corbett, banjo; Emma Beaton on vocals, and then Bridget Carney was on bass until the last like year or so, which was Zoe Giganow after that. But we had a blast, toured around Europe a bunch, and made three records when I was in the band.
Nice.
Yeah, it was fun.
And so part of your Berkeley experience too was studying with John McGann, who was a big influence on my music, on my life, and he's the one who told me about the River of Suck. At this point, I think it's time that I give the River of Suck spiel. It's funny because we talked a little bit earlier about how he never told you about the River of Suck.
Not that I can remember.
He told you what you needed to hear, and he told me what I needed to hear. Apparently, what he thought I needed to hear was the River of Suck. So you're standing on one edge of the River of Suck. Behind you is your comfort cave, your comfort shore. You're just hanging out there. And over on the other side, you can see little tiny, they're tiny because they're far away, little tiny versions of yourself who can do the things that you wish you could do now. The problem is in between current you and that future you who accomplished all those goals is the raging river of suck filled with whitewater rapids, thought piranhas, and rocks. Thought piranhas, of course, they're those kind of self-destructive thoughts that pop into your head and try to sabotage your good vibes. I'm not good enough. What do they think of my solo? Did I just slip up the time? Uh-oh, now my brain is overthinking. Now I'm lost in the song, wandering in the desert, all that kind of stuff. The idea is that in order to get from your comfort shore to the other side, accomplishing those goals, you have to suck at something before you can be good at it. You have to essentially be doing something poorly on your journey to doing it well. And a lot of people kind of dip their toe in and say, oh, this doesn't sound the way it should sound, and then they quit. So I guess what this concept is advocating for is to embrace fear of being bad during the learning process, and that's going to help get you to the other side of the river of suck, be able to do those things that you wish you could do now. But those little tiny steps, right? There's no plugging into the matrix. There's not really a shortcut. The shortcut is working on goals in a targeted way rather than like, I need to practice for 7 hours so I can get better at music, right? Mm-hmm. So setting specific goals allows you to get to the other side. Anyway, that's the river of suck. That's what John told me. So my question for you is, number one, does that resonate? Do you see the river of suck in your life and your music? And also, what did John McGann tell you?
It's funny that I don't remember him talking about the river of suck, because I love it and I absolutely resonate with all of it, hearing you say it now. So, I mean, I don't know how intentional that was, because I think, I don't know. But I do resonate with all of it, and it's a big part of how I think about getting better. Mm. And also, I know as like a 18, 19, you know, 20, 21-year-old, when I would have known John, like, I was way more scared of jumping into the river of suck than I am now.
Yeah.
You know, which is probably common, you know, but, you know, when I knew John, I do feel around that age I would have been, and I know for a fact, like, wary of the river of suck in a way that, you know, inhibited my ability to get better. I know. I mean, I think I did get better, and I personally put in a lot of hours, but like a good example would be like when I was at Berkeley, I didn't spend that much time playing jazz. Instead, I spent time playing bluegrass.
Yeah.
And, I played bluegrass with a lot of good people, and I was constantly shedding, but I was friends with a lot of great jazz musicians. But more often than not, I would sort of make them come to me and play bluegrass tunes because I was afraid of sucking, you know? That's so it seems so silly to me now. It honestly started seeming silly to me pretty soon after college, and I actually weirdly got really obsessed with playing jazz in the year after Berkeley. And sort of sad thing was that I felt like I made a lot of progress in the year right after Berkeley, and I hit John up like it would have been April after the May I graduated, being like, back in town, love to play. And I was so excited to play with him in 2012 because I'd really worked on the stuff, you know, that even in college that he was giving me that I wasn't working on enough. I don't think, because I was sort of a little bit too scared of working of playing jazz, and so there I was sort of working on the things I was already good at, you know, as
right.
Because it's more comfortable. And but then I never got to play with him again. It was like that month that he passed. But you know, in so much stuff that he talked about in our lessons is stuff I keep on coming back to, even very kind of specific.
Yeah. Can you relate any of that specifically?
I mean, you know, just talking about upper structure triads, upper structure seventh chords, the way he talked about them. And then there's, you know, you can get that from books, but also just getting to hear a mandolinist do it, you know, that makes a big difference. You know, it's the reason why there's so many more great jazz alto saxophonists than mandolin players, because they get to see it done. You know, they've seen the 4 minute mile already, you know. But I also, so some things that I remember about John that really impressed me, I just remember that anytime he would teach me an Irish or a Scottish tune, he would know all the names, and he would say all the names in the keys first, and then he would unaccompanied play like two times through each all in a row. And yeah. I just love the like mastery and sort of hard line he sort of had on knowing that stuff, like really knowing it. Because it's like you know, I've been playing some of that stuff recently, and I've kind of realized that knowing the names is really handy, and just giving the tunes identities. I'm not a real trad player at all, but it's just struck me how, like, right now I don't know what tunes I know, and he just seemed like he knew the tunes he knew, and he really knew them. And also, just on top of that, I was doing this a lot in my classes. As people were coming in, I would try to play something unaccompanied solo, you know, jazz tune or a bluegrass tune. And I think some of that's even from John, because he was just so like good at just like just on a dime, you know, who knows if he'd even played that day, just playing something unaccompanied. It's a whole sort of musical thing, arrangement, you know, that who knows how premeditated it is, but it was like a, you know, this perfect little thing that he could just deliver, you know, and that was really inspiring.
It's sort of flooding my mind with a couple other things that really stick out to me about John. He would talk about new techniques as something that you really work at home, and when you go to the gig, it might not be ready for the gig that night.
Absolutely. So
you might have to like put that new technique back in your mental box and wait till it's ready to come out at the gig. And as someone who kind of like dove it crashing into a lot of musical situations, not sometimes to in great success, but sometimes crash and burn for sure.
Yeah.
That particular advice sticks out. But I also remember there was a Django style jazz concert with Julian Lage and John McGann, and John was playing octave mandolin and Julian Lage was playing guitar. Obviously unbelievable guitar player.
Yeah.
And after the concert, the thing that I took away from it was John McGann is a really epic octave mandolin player.
Yeah.
And I was like so inspired by him and all the things that he played on octave mandolin, which is kind of a big unwieldy instrument in a way. And the thing that he said was like, oh man, playing with Julian Lage made me feel like I was trying to play this mandolin with oven mitts on.
It's so great.
I thought it was so funny because like my experience was like, whoa,
yeah.
I can't believe you can do that on an octave mandolin.
Yeah.
And the whole time he was just through his head, and this is the guy who as far as I know, invented the concept of the River of Suck. He had the thought piranhas to the point where that's all he could really say at the end.
Well, but and it's also like he was such a humble dude, and it's a funny line. He was such a funny dude, you know.
It was definitely a joke, too.
Yeah. I also think he was just one of those kind of musicians that really transcended it, the instrument. So it's like octave mandolin, guitar, mandolin. He could just kind of do it all of them, you know, and, which is so great. Yeah, I loved getting to watch him and Julian play together. That was so cool. Yeah, but the River of Suck thing, that is such a huge part of everything I do now. Like I was saying, when I was that age, I was so much less willing. I think part of it is like you're more to prove, kind of, and you really are just sort of obsessed with sounding good.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and being like, no, getting noticed, you know, like a, which part of that's like, yeah, you're trying to, you realize the imminence of you having to make a living soon, you know, that kind of thing. But now I really, the River of Suck thing is like, just every aspect of my practicing comes back to that. Like to the point where it's a lot less playing for me, a lot less playing things like perfectly, really slow.
Yeah.
Like I do that a lot, but I also do a lot of like, let's try it at full speed. Let's see what happens if I, where do I mess it up if I play it at full speed? Where do I mess it up if I play it when I'm totally cold? Like, I was talking about, in these classes, starting with something solo, a lot of times before I start practicing these days and maybe start with slow with the metronome or something, instead I play a tune the whole way through unaccompanied. Of course, it's just me, so it's unaccompanied, but no metronome. Just because almost like I was performing, because I just want to sort of know where I'm actually at. Like when I'm totally cold, you know, where are my chops actually at? You know, where's my improvisational ability at? So, but also then it sucks a lot of the time too. So, but
and that's a real life situation too. Like if you're going to guest on someone else's gig with some friends and they've been on stage warmed up and you're just sitting there, you can't look away. So then you're not actually holding your instrument and they call your name, you run up and you get this big endorphin rush and you're not warmed up at all.
Yeah.
And you still have to send it.
Man, that, there's a couple things that I thought of to do with that. It's, you know, I have, for a lot of my life, been pretty, like, OCD about having to warm up before playing, you know, especially when I was younger. And, you know, I have my own group, and we tour quite a lot. And when I'm out with my group, you know, we don't have a tour manager or sound guy or anything, so I'm taking care of everything, you know. I mean, my band's great, but like, you know, I'm paying them to play, and it's sort of my responsibility. They're playing my music. It's my responsibility to do everything else, you know? And so I do it, and I don't mind doing that stuff, but the reality is there's not always a lot of time for me to like warm up on my instrument.
Sure.
Well, a couple things. Well, like, honestly, for me, having my own band, one of the good things about it is it actually gets me less out of my head when it comes to my own playing, because there's so much other stuff to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually find myself sort of playing better because I have too much other stuff to think about, you know?
Yeah.
So in the last, it was actually the beginning of this year. I remember I started at playing Woodford Folk Festival in Australia. So it was like over the new year, I started making a practice of not warming up before the show. And some of that actually came from when I was playing with Bela last year, him talking about touring with this piano player who, in his opinion, he would get on stage with this piano player and always get his butt kicked. You know, I'm sure Bela was playing great, but he was saying that to me in regard to the fact that, like, I was sort of saying, I think I've been practicing too much before the shows and kind of getting in my own head. And he was saying, well, this piano player, you know, he never could warm up because he didn't have a piano backstage and he would always just play like crazy, you know, like play so great. And so, you know, never had the option to warm up. So I, at the beginning of this year, I started not warming up, like, on purpose.
Okay.
Like, I always, you know, I'm an obsessive practicer, so my hands are pretty warm in terms of, like, in shape, you know? Like, yeah. I would usually practice earlier in the day. But I stopped warming up before the shows, go on almost completely cold. It's also, it's like my music, so it's, like, almost like, you know, if it does lose anything, it's still just my gig that it's losing something on. You know what I mean? It's not like I'm messing up someone else's stuff.
Yeah.
But for me, what I actually noticed, you know, as someone that, like, you know, is playing all the time, I didn't notice any drop off in my ability to improvise and play, and it broke me of this sort of reliance on having to warm up, and therefore made me much more comfortable in those situations where I can't warm up, because it's like I'm not habituated to think I need to warm up.
Totally.
And I'm not saying there's nothing to be gained from warming up. I just think that I was too obsessive the other way for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to go back to practicing for a second. You said, say, in the Berkeley era, you were practicing in a certain way where you really wanted to sound good and you cared a lot about what people think and getting noticed. And, well, something Chris Howes said in just the last podcast that I did was, if it sounds good, you're not really practicing. And it sounds like you've been moving for many years in that direction. So what do you think changed emotionally for you in terms of your mindset when you're in those quiet moments at home?
I think some of it is that when you're that age, you have this desire to be like better yesterday, or it's, you know what I mean? It's like zero patience, you know, and like, you can't do anything, assuming you have the discipline to put the hours in, you can't really do anything to speed up the process at that point. Like, even when you're young and pick up stuff quick, you know, you still got to, like, build the muscle, you know, or build the ability and then sleep on it. And then maybe the next day you're better, maybe 2 days from now you're better. It's always a gradual thing.
Right.
And I think now that I'm not like, no, I can't change. I'm not going to be like a hotshot up and coming player anymore because I'm 35. You know, I'm a player. You know, I'm lucky to be a professional musician, but I'm not worried about being like, you know, one of the up and coming young bucks. You know, that's like it's the ship has sailed on that. I either was or I wasn't, and I can't do anything about it. And so I'm just sort of now in this sort of, you know, close to middle aged, and you know, like I said, lucky to be playing for a living. But it's like, I think there's like knowing in theory there's no rushing it, but still really trying to rush it versus really feeling in sort of a more deep way that, like, yeah, I can't rush this, and like I can continue to put the hours in and be really focused. But yeah, hopefully that, I think that's what changed.
Is there anything that has to do with fear or what other people think that affected that?
I think also in the last 15 years, there's, you know, or more, there's just been a lot of like, yeah, I blew that solo. I blew that solo in front of a hero. I blew that solo in front of five heroes. You know, I blew that solo in front of a bunch of people when I was in, you know, Yonder, or I blew that song that I wrote. I mean, just like I've you know, every manner of mess ups I've done. And, you know, The first time it really stinks when that happens, and the second time it does, but eventually you do get numb to it. And for me, that doesn't mean it lessens the desire to want to play well. It's just this realization that, like, you know, and listening back a lot, it's like, oh yeah, those mess ups, yeah, it's not what I wanted to sound like, but it was quick and it was done and I didn't lose the gig because of it. Also realizing that a lot more gigs are won and lost based on whether or not you're a pain in the butt. And honestly, yeah, somebody who's always getting on stage and belly aching about how bad they played, it's not the easiest thing to be around. And I was that guy plenty of the time. And I mean, you know, it's sort of like humble in one regard. It's like you're so self-deprecating about your playing. And on the other hand, you're sort of turning all the attention towards how you think you played versus like, what if everyone else had a great time?
Right.
And you got off stage and all you're talking about is how you didn't think you played well. And it's just like, nobody cares, you know, like you kind of play like you play. Like, yeah.
Yeah. That's super real. I mean, in the moment when it comes to music that involves improvisation, you can't know how it's going to go, which means that whatever happens, you sort of have to either accept or beat yourself up about it. And regardless of your response to it, it still happened.
Yeah.
So that's where I think it's important that we have a choice of how we respond in that moment. Like, we can't control our emotions, how we feel, how physically, electrically, our brain waves like pulse, but we can absolutely stop and think before we say something like that. So
yeah,
I want to dig deeper a little bit into like just the self-deprecating thing. I mean, since it's so relatable to so many people, like, can you give any of those thought piranhas names, like things that you used to say that you would never say again after a gig?
I think there was a lot of after gigs like completely redefining how you thought about yourself, which is like so unhealthy. You know, this like a lot of like toggling between thinking I'm so great and thinking I'm terrible.
Oh,
and we're in reality, like, you know, hopefully the answer is somewhere in between, you know? But like that toggling just feels unhealthy. And also like just too much in general, too much your identity is sort of wrapped up in the last note you played.
Right.
Which then leads to playing worse, I think, because you're, yeah, it's like if your life and identity hangs on every solo, you know?
Yeah. So like, okay. So judging the quality of you and your worth as a human being based on the last solo you played is a high stakes game.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of us probably have that, who spend a lot of time playing, and it's a big part of our life. It's like hard to avoid, but it's also like, it's just, you know, that's not what makes you a better person, obviously. And it's you know, it's not the thing, you know, are your good friends going to judge you on having blown a solo or something? Like, of course not, you know? Honestly, you're not, this is another thing I've realized, I think, that makes me a little less fearful, maybe. It's just like, I really do just play like I play. Mm-hmm. Like, I have nights that are better than others, but the nights I feel like transcendent probably weren't actually that much better than my normal nights. And the nights where I feel like I was horrible probably weren't that much worse, you know? And it's really like, yeah, trying to avoid that toggling up and down. I've also done, like, I record almost every show,
mm-hmm.
and that's, and every, even a lot of jam sessions. And that's really informative to me to know that I really can't even judge in the moment what's going on.
Right.
Yeah. Like, it's almost predictably the opposite, in that, like, I'll feel really confident about how I played and I'll listen back and be like, no, I was rushing. You know, or playing too loud, or playing too many notes, or who knows, playing too much, or something was not as I was perceiving it. And then other times I'll have nights where I feel like I was just hanging on for dear life the whole night. I'll listen back and be like, no, I was like grooving way harder that night, barely hanging on. I've actually had the experience of being completely lost, like completely lost, and listening back. And in this weird way, I was playing in a more groovy way, being completely lost, because I was so in tune with every beat because I had no idea where we were. I was looking for anything to grasp onto. And if, like, even if I literally don't know which way is up, it sounded better than I do sometimes when I'm confident. So it's like that, the total lack of objectivity in the moment has helped. And being that being sort of like ingrained over a period of years of listening back. You know?
Yeah. I think it's so true. You know, Eugene Friesen, did you get to interact with him at Berklee too?
Bunch, yeah.
So he's my free improv hero, and certainly my how to teach free improv Sessions hero. And I recently got to do a gig with him and Ian Curry, which was so fun.
Sick.
And I went to his free improv workshop, and he had a couple of rules. And one of the rules was, it doesn't have to be good. And I really liked that. Just laying it out. We're going to play music. It doesn't have to be good. But it really raises the question, and this is part of why I do this podcast and talk about it, because everyone wants to be able to play with the freedom, so-called freedom from fear, without worrying. How do you play without worrying and know that, like, yes, you know you can listen later, but in the moment, how do you focus on what's actually important, like listening to the other musicians? You know, it's not necessarily all about you. It's sort of like the team sound together. So what do you do in the moment to give yourself permission to not worry?
So, like, I feel like the way I felt about my playing and what the recordings will sometimes show, while those are totally antithetical sometimes, I feel like the way I play and the way my band plays is almost completely correlated with how we're all hanging out and all getting along, which is that, you know, like, I'm really lucky that guys I tour with and my group, we get along really, really well and we have so much fun. And so the way I think this relates to what you're asking is that, like, when interacting musically and performing musically is this sort of natural extension of the hang and whatever thing you were joking around about right before. Like, I played my best in some of the shows where I was not warming up and we were just like losing our minds laughing about something before we went on. Like, to me, that's like the best headspace to start a show from, because it's also not about you and about impressing people. And so, yeah, for me, the most effective thing, even though, like, I just, like everyone else, have a, you know, strong tendency to want to think how I'm come across and just wanting to play well, but the more I can really turn the focus towards the communal playing and also just practically speaking, like, I really try to listen to what the other people are doing, and it helps me not rush, helps me not play too loud, certainly helps me come up with ideas when I'm improvising. And you know, when my band, we improvise a ton, you know, and that's, a lot of my tunes are kind of vehicles for that. So we really have to be getting along and you have to be listening. There can't be like passive aggressive timing things going on. I've certainly experienced
that. The worst.
It's the worst. And it's no way to live, if you ask me. But and there's none of that, honestly, in my group. Or maybe I'm just the leader and so everyone's listening to me. I mean, there's always a chance that some of it's that. But, you know, we are like sometimes, like, you know, really. Some of my favorite times on tour to this day are like when everyone is just losing their minds laughing about something in the van, you know, and it's just the best. And that's, for me, all the best music, and the music where I'm the least in my head kind of springs from that. So I try to foster as many settings like that as possible.
Totally. So your band, you're more in control. What about when it's not your band and you're not in control of the situation?
Well, all the listening stuff certainly applies.
Yeah.
I like having a band, you know, and you know, being the boss in that sense. But I also really like being a sideman.
Mm-hmm.
I like working for somebody. There's sort of real clear. The expectations are very clear when you're the boss or you're working for somebody, you know. But also, there's like obviously a lot of amazing music that comes out of democratic bands.
Yeah.
But I do feel like it's the most challenging type of organization, certainly musically. I think I'm better at being part of those now than I was when I was younger. I think it's good to do a healthy amount of all those things. But you know, I was just doing this really amazing project a couple of weeks ago that was totally democratic, and that had one of the best vibes I've ever experienced. And granted, it's not something that works all the time, and so there's sort of, when you're part of a democratic band and it's everyone's end all, that's when, you know, egos get really involved, I think, and a lot of headbutting and just people's irreconcilable calendars gets involved. And, you know, so anyway, this was a democratic project that just works a couple times a year. It was just some of the best vibes, you know, but it's all, you know, cyclical, and like, you know, if you're bringing a good vibe, you know, other people are more likely to do that too. Because I guess it's sort of like trash talking. Like once one person gets it going, somebody will be jumping in, and it sort of gets, you know,
can spiral.
Spirals, yeah. So, yeah. But the opposite can also happen, I think, if you're, you know, yeah, it's like if you're playing with people that really listen, I think you're more likely to really listen, you know.
I think that's something that I've experienced being more aware of as I get older too, just that the way that you act and the way the things that you say do affect the people around you. And if you want it to go a certain direction and you don't think about it, it's really easy for it to do the spiral out of control and you don't know why it happened. But then if you're a little more conscientious about what you say and how you say it and to who, and think about where everyone else might be in a vulnerable moment. You know, I don't always think about it, but I have found that if I don't think about it, I'm more likely to spiral. And if I do think about it, we're more likely to bring people up together. And really, when you're talking about the hang and people you care about, it seems like that should be important.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, the whole you only live once and you're out here playing music and what is there really to be bummed about?
You know?
I mean, obviously there's a lot in the world to be bummed out, but if you're getting to go out and play instrumental music for like an audience that's excited to hear it, like, you know, can you really afford to get dark on that? Like, it's pretty great.
Complainosaurus Rex.
Exactly.
Let's talk about practicing for a second. Because, you know, you say you're an obsessive practicer. And I just wonder, and a lot of people listening to this podcast want to practice and they want to get better. So how do you think about practicing? Is there anything you can share for our listeners here about the practice process?
Well, one thing I want to say that relates to what you were talking about, you know, kind of shed something a lot one day and you kind of want that to come out on stage that night or in the jam that night. The sort of impatience with the stuff you're working with. That is something, like with a lot of the other aspects of the River of Suck, I've had to really realize that, like, I almost need to completely differentiate the two. It's almost like I want to need to put the hours in and then just forget about it and just let myself just completely just sort of relapse into however I play, you know, not worry about trying to implement anything new. I mean, obviously, it's impossible, in my opinion, to implement anything new technically on stage or in a jam. I really don't think you can implement anything harmonically that isn't fully absorbed without it just seeing, like, shoehorned in. Like, I really think, for me, certainly having played in a lot of like high pressure settings, the idea of having the conscious thought to affect any change in that way when you're in this high pressure situation just is kind of ridiculous. Like, it needs to be only stuff that, for me, it's like only stuff that I've mastered comes out. And the more I can accept that and realize that, like, oh, okay, if that like harmonic thing or technical change, if it's not coming out yet, I can't rush it. Like, it's going to put in the hours tomorrow. And who knows? You know, I have had like a fun, like, epiphonic, like, I don't know if that's how you say it, like, moments, but they've always come from just months or weeks or, you know, certainly hours and hours of working on something. And yeah, like, it might, but actually I will say the way that tends to happen for me is, like, say with a technical change, I'll get a glimpse of it in the practice room, and then I'll get more and more frequent glimpses of it in the practice room, and then maybe it sort of becomes how a part of how I play in the practice room. And then I'll get my first glimpse of it on stage or in a jam. And then the same process happens again. It's like the higher the pressure, the longer it takes for that to be like the default for my muscles or for my brain, you know? For me, it's also why I like to put time, if I can practice in the morning and then take a nice break before I'm sort of performing. That's nice. I can't always do that. If I was, you know, 100% great at just toggling between the mindsets, I could practice right up into the show, but it's pretty hard. And I actually feel like the closer I get to the show, especially if it's like my music, the more I need to sort of feel in a sense like a finished product that's ready to be put out there, even though I don't actually feel like that, but I need to start to sort of embody that in order to sort of have the confidence to go up and do it, if that makes sense. So that's why I love practicing in the morning, period, but talking just a little bit more about practicing, I had a really fun workshop here on practicing techniques. I'm pretty organized about it these days because I have so much to work on. Not in a sense of stuff I just like things I need to tackle before I die. There's a lot of that, but there's also like practically speaking, like I'm making a new record with my band, making a record with Michael Daves, I'm learning this mandolin concerto. There's like just all these different things where it's like got to kind of keep my eye on the ball. There's a lot of also just working on the next thing I have to do the next weekend. So I was saying to my class this weekend, like what I have noticed a sort of like a magic zone for me, which is like a 45-minute to an hour and 15-minute practice session, where for me that's, you know, I've also had inspiring 5-minute practice sessions and inspiring 6-hour practice sessions. But come back to the mindset thing, I found that like I'm particularly more likely to get dark on practicing if I sort of push way beyond an hour and 15 minutes without a break for probably some just obvious physiological reasons. You know, you're not feeling as good and maybe need water. who knows? I mean, I used to go to the Berkeley practice rooms for 6-hour blocks with basically no break, you know, and a stopwatch. Like it was 6 hours. Yeah. I used to do 10-hour practice days on the weekend at Berkeley.
When you say it gets dark, like what can you elaborate? Like what is happening?
Yeah. I mean, I can pretty much count on no matter what the first like 45-minute to an hour and 15-minute or so practice session of the day being a pretty healthy headspace for me. Hmm. Sort of like a magic thing I can almost totally count on. Yeah. I think it's a combination of coffee, being a morning person, and just like I'm probably the least in my head that time of day. And so when I say pushing beyond that, and this is approximations, but I like that that range. And I do use like a stopwatch for it too, just to know, because you can lose perspective if you don't. If I sort of push way beyond that, a lot of times what will happen is I'll start losing focus. And for me, that doesn't take the shape of noodling. I'm not a big noodler when I'm practicing. Not to say there's anything wrong with that. You can have some inspired noodling sessions, but I'm not going to get distracted in terms of like going off topic in that way or something. It's more that I'll find that my mental space starts just being bogged down by thoughts of like, is this how I should practice this? Is this how I should practice? And I'm really not even thinking about what I'm doing anymore. I'm just thinking like, is this the right way to do it? Is this the right way to do it? And I've heard interviews with Chris Potter, who's one of my favorite musicians, and also obviously touted as one of the greatest living saxophone players and an obsessive practicer. But I've heard him say he doesn't feel like he knows how to practice. And for me, that's something I'm constantly questioning. And in these moments, especially when I push it too far, like, do I know how to practice? And then I'll have thoughts of like, does practicing actually do anything? I think maybe I just need to have been naturally better. I don't think practicing, even though like everything my whole life sort of flies in the face of that, insofar as I'm pretty convinced I'm better than I was 20 years ago.
I want to be better yesterday.
Yeah, I want to be better yesterday, yeah. And so I do feel like I know the practice session is getting a little derailed when my headspace is sort of no longer in the moment with what's going on and more worrying about, is this the right way? Does practicing do anything? Am I just no good? My time's no good. Is my tone no good? It's just kind of worrying all of a sudden about these big identity things and no longer the actual what's happening in the moment. Like,
yeah.
So I like to, when I'm in a sort of like space where I, you know, weeks or months where I have like a lot to practice.
Do you have like a way to redirect that energy?
It's really hard for me to redirect. I really think it tends to happen when I've practiced for too long and there's almost nothing other than stopping that I can do. Yeah.
Take a break.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe other people would have, a way, but for me, I've hardly ever, after it's kind of off the rails, I kind of need to take a break. Mm. For me, you know, and a break, you know, I don't mean days. I mean, like it might be a few hours, you know, like, but I do think I tend to be pretty positive in general and I can kind of get my mindset back on track pretty quick. But, these days I do, when I'm home, a default is to have three, I have my to-do list. It's M1, M2, M3, like mandolin 1, 2, 3, which is like 3 45-minute to hour and 15-minute sessions. Mm. And then sometimes I'll recreationally practice a couple more hours on top of that on stuff I just want to practice. But I'll assign what those are going to be, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, if that makes sense. Yeah.
The reason I interview a lot of professional musicians, and I have a lot of people listening, maybe you're listening right now, who music is a big part of your life, but maybe you're not a professional and struggle with these questions of identity and the struggle to get the sound in your head to come out of your instrument. So I just think it's so great to hear that all the professional musicians are struggling with these same negative thoughts and that we're all feeling this stuff together. And for me, the more I talk about it, the more it puts it in perspective.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like I'm out there swimming in the river of suck by myself.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, totally. And I do think like the river of suck thing, which I so love, I feel like right now I'm swimming in like multiple rivers of suck and like really enjoying it.
Yeah.
And like not... You know, I definitely suck sometimes when I play bluegrass, but like that's like kind of my home territory, mm-hmm. you know, and the thing I'm least fearful of. Like I do that a lot, but I've been lately doing a lot of things that are, it's like I'm uncomfortable with it and just feel lucky to get to do it.
Would you be down to show us on the mandolin, like what you feel like your current river of suck is?
Well, I mean, honestly, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, let's see. You know, it's the Irish triplets.
Ah, thing, yeah.
It just messed with me. Like some days I have it, other days I don't. The what's the tune? See, that was supposed to be one. It's just like my hands are a little cold and it's just like they're not happening right now. So there's like a lot of that. Speaking of sucking. So that's something that I'm working on a lot. I mean, my tone I sometimes think sucks. And so I will spend like hours with my head like in front of my mandolin just trying to make my notes like more legato. Yeah, yeah. Or I mean, I have to kind of break it up. I have to stand up in between. But I'll try to figure out how to make my tone something I like better. A lot of trying to, you know, like play more legato, kind of make sure the notes are all connected.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm working on something more specific than just that noodling. But so that's something I do a lot that I think sucks. I mean, yeah, I guess most of everything I work on, is something like you say I'm not very good at. I was trying to I had to take this really fast solo in 11/8.
Oh yeah.
And I never played in 11/8, and we were in the studio doing it.
How did you subdivide that?
3/3/3/2.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was like or like 6/6/6/4, like
oh yeah.
But it was also like kind of weird chords, and it was just, it was so bad. But I got ended up with something that was, I think, decent, you know. But yeah, in the moment, I was just like,
Did you compose a solo?
No. I don't mean, I wasn't composing a solo. I just, like every morning, you know, we knew we had to record in like 48 hours. I was getting up every morning, you know, well, the two mornings I had, and playing for a long time in 11/8. And yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, I spent a lot of that solo lost, you know, but I, you know, got to the end of it, and it seems pretty good now, but certainly not transcended, I don't think, but yeah.
We do our best, then we move on to the next thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I don't know how to fix the Irish triplet thing. I mean, we're working on it, but it's like, it's one of those fast twitch muscle things that I'd be like, there's the double down thing that needs to happen, and yeah, it
yeah, the
sucks.
Double down is hard.
Yeah.
Do we have any questions from our live audience? It's Eric Kilburn from Wellspring Sound. Come on up.
Jake, play us, if you have a chance, or talk a little bit about techniques that you used in developing speed and cleanliness over soloing.
Yeah. I don't do a lot of like working on speed in terms of like, you know, playing it at 120 and then playing it 124 and then 128, working it up in that sense. I do a lot of playing things, and a lot of this comes from that Kenny Warner Effortless Mastery book. And it's also kind of things I was already doing, and then I read that book, and like he kind of puts great, you know, words to it. But you know, I play things really slow and really cleanly, and that also is maybe where I get into like putting my head in front of my instrument, making sure stuff is really legato. I've you know made this point in a couple classes, but I don't think you can play anything fast that you can't play legato. And by legato on the mandolin, I just mean like making the notes as connected as possible, like one note ringing into the next note. So, because if you think about it, like if the notes aren't connected, even when it's slow, that disconnected amount of the note is going to become a bigger and bigger percentage of it as you speed it up. You know, I guess it's building coordination at the end of the day. But so, and the other way to think about it is that when you're playing something slow, if you're playing it completely legato, like connecting each note, absolutely not switching till the next note. The actual switch that your fingers are making is the same speed as it would be at a fast tempo, because like absolute sustain is absolute sustain. Does that make sense? Kind of. Being really picky when it's slow, so it's really slow and really clean and really perfect. But then the other, I think if you only do that, I wish I could just do that, and then it would sort of just speed up in a linear way, like one day it's a little bit faster, next day it's a little faster. I've never noticed that working for me. The other part of the equation is that I need to do a lot of tossing myself into the deep end. And by that, I mean I play maybe full speed on something, but I play completely effortlessly. And by that, and so obviously, you know, if you can play perfectly and at speed and effortlessly, then that's great. But most of us can't. So what you have to concede in that moment is allow it to be sloppy. So let it be really sloppy. And by that, whatever you need to do to make it feel effortless, even if that means like it sounds terrible. So a lot of like jumping in at speed. But it has to stay completely effortless. And the way you do that is by just letting it, your hands do what they'll do at that speed. And what I think a lot of people do is a lot of sort of fast, sort of at tempo speed. That's kind of accurate, but not quite. And that's not effortless at all. And so the idea is to keep it so slow on the one hand that it's effortless because it's really, really slow and perfect. And then when it's at speed, it's effortless and you're sort of conceding the accuracy. And then the third step, and this is all in the Kenny Warner book, and this one I do a lot of, is I loop work on a very small amount of what I'm working on. So it's like the three-pronged approach. And so I'd be take like a bar or a half bar, like a trouble. It'll either be like a trouble spot in the thing, or if it's like I'm working on playing something that's kind of hard the whole way through, I'll go through with a fine tooth comb through the whole thing this way, taking bar at a time, making sure I can play that bar at speed, you know, or faster than speed. But all that to say, I don't do hardly any working on pushing from 150 to 160 or 160 to 180. It's more that like I feel like if I can find an effortless way to play something, my hands will pretty much do it at however kind of fast my like fast twitch muscle fiber will carry me. But I also know from doing it enough, I know that if it's not effortless, that there's no point in me like, or that it won't be possible at the super fast speeds. Because it's like the only things that really happen at the really fast speeds are what is totally effortless. You know what I mean? Especially in bluegrass, where it's not just that you're eking out a fast lick real quick. It's that you have to actually be able to hang at like 160 for a whole tune. And that's just longer than anyone can like grit it out. You know what I mean? It has to be like falling off a log. I mean, you see like my favorite players, you know, your Ronnie McCurry's, you know, your Brian Sutton's, Norman Blake, people like that. It's like they figured out a way to play what they play in this way where the hands just know how to do it. You know, it's just, it's effortless. So that's the kind of thing I think about with speed. And not a lot of exercises. I pretty much most anything I'm trying to work up to speed is like a piece of music I'm trying to do. You know, some amount of scales and patterns like that, but that, I wouldn't say that has anything to do with developing speed. You can work on speed on any fiddle tune or, you know, Irish tune or whatever. You know, it's really in how you work on it more than any given exercise. Yeah. Yeah, you bet. Yeah.
And as a sort of a barometer of when you feel like it's relaxed, is probably how your right hand feels more than your left.
Both, very much both. A lot of times, my left hand is the slowest thing. Yeah, and that's, you know, part of it is like I worked on my right hand a lot, but also it's just that mandolin players focus on their right hand and underdevelop their left hand a lot of the time. You know, it doesn't get a lot of focus because a lot of the tunes that bluegrass mandolin players play aren't very left hand involved. Like it's an open keys, a lot of open strings. But when you're working on, I haven't worked on a lot of like Bach and stuff, but a little bit, and then a lot of like bebop vocabulary and stuff. It's like very left hand involved. And I think the average bluegrass mandolin player trying to tackle that stuff is going to be really held up by the left hand of it, you know? Yeah, so it's really both hands. Sometimes, and in fact, there's like, sometimes I'll think it's a right-hand problem and discover it's a left-hand problem. Yeah, so it's worth sort of checking out both, yeah. And, well, sorry, one other thing. When you do loop a really small amount of music, like 4 notes, 8 notes, a couple things about that. It helps you discover if it's a left-hand or right-hand. Another interesting thing is, say you want to work on speed over like Big Sciota or something. If you just take one bar and loop that over and over again, I think it gives your hands a chance to sort of evolve and find a new way to play it. That doesn't happen if you only play that bar like separated by 20 seconds of other stuff. It's like the kind of quick memory. For me, it's like without having to make any conscious change, if I just loop 8 notes in a row, it's like my hands, that becomes the new normal, and they sort of like evolve around what will allow them to do that 8 notes. And say then you do that, maybe you get so you can do that 130 or 140 or even slower, but you might get so you can do it faster than you can play the fiddle tune. But the reality is you're playing constant 8th notes at this speed that's higher than where you can usually hang. So is playing that one bar for 30 seconds actually harder than playing the whole tune? And let, you know, barring it, like there's some weird cross picky thing or something that's particularly hard, not really. You know, it's you're figured out how to do constant 8th notes at that speed. So then it's just a matter of doing that with every bar of the tune, if that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. It's so great to have you here live at Fiddle Hell.
Thanks
for
having me. On
the River of Suck podcast, Jake. Where can people find you on the internet? Can they follow you anywhere? Can they listen to stuff? Can they buy stuff? What do we do?
www.jacobjolliffe.com. My last name, Jolliff.
Two L's, two F's.
Yeah. And one or multiple of those gets left out with frequency on posters.
That'll
for
bring you to the wrong
festivals.
Website. Don't go to that one.
Yeah. I have a bunch of albums out and going to be putting out a couple more in the next year. I'm recording a new, like, all original, all instrumental thing. And yeah, and a bunch of other stuff. And then a bunch of touring with my group, Jake Jolliffe Band, next year.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And you got a relatively new jazz record with Grant Gordy?
The record with Grant, yeah, we put it out last year. And I have a record that came out like a couple months ago that's like a democratic thing with me, Alex Beagleman on bass clarinet, and Jason Berger on snare drum. So it's that classic sound, snare drum, bass clarinet, mandolin, playing jazz standards. So right now I have more albums of jazz standards out than bluegrass, which is kind of weird because I still like to think a lot better at bluegrass. But anyhow, it should be tied after I put out this next instrumental record.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Even out those numbers, nice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Nobody ever said crossing the river of suck would be easy or that you had to do it alone. So I want to thank you for tuning in and giving it a chance. You can support this podcast for just $1 a month by visiting riverofsuckswimteam.com. That's right, it's a Patreon page, folks. It's just a Patreon page, but really appreciate your support, Jake Jolliffe.
Thanks
for
having me.
What a pleasure to talk about all this hardcore practicing mental strategy game stuff. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. No, it's just right up my alley, and you're doing a great thing here, man. It's very inspiring.
Till next time, keep swimming. Thank you. Well,
love that.